Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, we discussed what was called debt serfdom for American workers. The mighty United States has been in the banking spider sights for more than two centuries, it turns out. It too has now been captured in the spider's web, choked in the debt spun out of thin air. Today, the United States has surpassed even third world countries in its debt level. By 2004, the debt of the U.S. government had hit $7.6 trillion, more than three times that of all third world countries combined. Today, that has risen to $14.8 trillion. Like the bankrupt consumer who stays afloat by making the minimum payment on his credit card, the government has avoided bankruptcy by paying just the interest on the monster debt. But even that mounting bill could very soon be more than the government can afford to pay. So long as the debt is in U.S. dollars, the government can just print its way out of insolvency. But if the dollar loses its status as global reserve currency, and the U.S. winds up in debt in some other currency, it could well find itself on the road to actual bankruptcy. Alan Martin is a retired naval intelligence officer, former contributor to the Presidential Council of Economic Advisers, and author of a weekly newsletter called Behind the Scenes in the Beltway. In an April 2005 newsletter, he noted that the ratio of total U.S. debt, public and private, to gross domestic product, the GDP, has risen to 308%. That's April 2005. The International Monetary Fund considers a nation state with a total debt to GDP ratio of 200% or more to be a deconstructed third world nation state. What does that mean? Martin wrote, quote, "What deconstructed actually means is that a political regime in that country or series of political regimes have, through a long period of fraud, abuse, graft, corruption, and mismanagement, effectively collapsed the economy of that country," end quote. Other commentators have warned that the shock therapy tested in third world countries was the next step planned for the United States. Editorialist Mike Whitney wrote in Counterpunch in April 2005, quote, "The towering national debt coupled with the staggering trade deficits have put the nation on a precipice, and a seismic shift in the fortunes of middle-class Americans is looking more likely all the time. The country has been intentionally plundered and will eventually wind up in the hands of its creditors. This same Ponzi scheme has been carried out repeatedly by the IMF and World Bank throughout the world. Bankruptcy is a fairly straightforward way of delivering valuable public assets and resources to collaborative industries and of annihilating national sovereignty. After a nation is successfully driven to destitution, public policy decisions are made by creditors and not by representatives of the people. The catastrophe that middle-class Americans face is what these elites breezily refer to as shock therapy. A sudden jolt followed by fundamental changes to the system. In the near future, we can expect tax reform, fiscal discipline, deregulation, free capital flows, lower tariffs, reduced public services, and privatization," end quote. Catherine Austin Fitz was formerly the managing director of a Wall Street investment bank and was Assistant Secretary of Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, under President George Bush Sr. She called what was happening to the economy a criminal leveraged buyout of America, something she defined as buying a country for cheap with its own money and then jacking up the rents and fees to steal the rest. She also called it the American tapeworm model. Quote, "The American tapeworm model is to simply finance the federal deficit through warfare, current exports, treasury and federal credit borrowing, and cutbacks in domestic discretionary spending. This will then place local municipalities and local leadership in a highly vulnerable position, one that will allow them to be persuaded with bogus but high-minded sounding arguments to further cut resources. Then, to preserve bond ratings and the rights of creditors, our leaders can be persuaded to sell our water, natural resources, and infrastructure assets at significant discounts of their true value to global investors. This will all be described as a plan to save America by recapitalizing it on a sound financial footing. In fact, this process will simply shift more capital continuously from America to other continents and from the lower and middle class to elites," end quote. As we talked about before, in 1894, Jacob Coxey warned of the destruction of the great American middle class. That prediction is rapidly materializing as the gap between rich and poor grows ever wider. And I'll continue in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you're listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the destruction of the great American middle class. Now this is from the Federal Reserve, which, of course, has its own agenda, but these facts are really pointing to the probable truth, which is actually worse. The wealthiest 1% of Americans held 33.4% of the nation's wealth, up from 30.1% in 1989, while the top 5% held 55.5% of the wealth. The poorest 50% of the population held only 2.5% of the wealth, down from 3% in 1989. The very wealthiest 1% of Americans owned a bigger piece of the pie, 33.4%, than the poorest 90%, who owned 30.4% of the pie. They also owned 62.3% of the nation's business assets. And then finally, the wealthiest 5% owned 93.7% of the value of bonds, 71.7% of non-residential real estate, and 79.1% of the nation's stocks. And again, because of the source, we can presume that these figures are actually quite conservative. Forbes magazine reported that from 1997 to 1999, the wealth of the 400 richest Americans grew by a percentage of $940 million each, for a daily increase of $1.3 million per person. Note that lists of this sort do not include the world's truly richest families, including the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, and a long list of royal families. Whether they consider it to be in bad taste or because they fear retribution from the bottom of the wealth pyramid, the super elite do not make their fortunes public. While the super rich were amassing fortunes rivaling the economies of small countries, Americans in the lower brackets are struggling with food and medical bills. Personal bankruptcy filings more than doubled from 1995 to 2005, when the bankruptcy code was revised. In 2004, more than 1.1 million consumers filed for bankruptcy under Chapter 7. A Chapter 7 bankruptcy stays on the creditor's credit record for 10 years from the date of filing, but at least it wipes the slate clean. In 2005, this escape was challenged for some of the debtors. Under sweeping new provisions to the bankruptcy code, more people are now required to file under Chapter 13, which is a payback plan, not totally eliminating the debt. And the plan is for 60 months. Another issue is homestead exemptions, which have traditionally protected homes from foreclosure in bankruptcy. But not all states have them, and the statutes usually preserve only a fraction of the home's worth. Of course, when you have a home, you have to be current on the mortgage to keep the home, even in bankruptcy. But let's suppose you are current. Can the other unsecured creditors go after the house? In a state like Iowa, which has unlimited homestead exemption, generally only creditors that were unsecured and had debt before you got the house could look to the equity if none of that debt was paid down before you got the home. This is not a very usual situation, and so Iowa has a strong homestead exemption as long as people are paying their mortgage. The second issue is if, in fact, the house does go to foreclosure and there's not enough money on the sale to cover the mortgage. That means there's a deficiency in what is owed to the bank on the note. Some states don't have any protection against this, and that's going to be unsecured debt and has to be dealt with under the various provisions of the bankruptcy law. In Iowa, for example, we have, as do some states, anti-deficiency laws that generally apply to that circumstance, and that debt would go away in the bankruptcy. Or even if there was not a bankruptcy and there was a foreclosure, it's usually chosen by the lender to waive the deficiency to accelerate their ability to get the house. Iowa has a very strong provision for a delay of sale when there's a foreclosure. So waiving the deficiency accelerates that sale. As an aside, it should be noted that the equity in one's home is very valuable. to the creditors who use that as if it were extra savings that the debtor could tap into. This is not a good idea, and the home, the homestead, should not be looked at as a savings account ever. There have been pushes to persuade homeowners to take out home equity loans as far back as the 1920s to persuade people to borrow against their homes to invest in the stock market. When the stock market crashed, their homes became the property of the banks. Also, elderly people burdened with medical and drug bills are particularly susceptible to those tactics today. But the commercialized sale of home equity as a savings account to be used to the quote-unquote benefit of the debtors has really been highly promoted, and people are lured into essentially converting unsecured debt into secured debt, the unsecured debt being dischargeable in bankruptcy while the secured debt would not be dischargeable. Normally, people look to the states to provide a safety net for the citizens against personal disasters, but states have been driven to the brink of bankruptcy as well. Diversion of state funds to out-of-control federal spending has left states with budget crises that have forced them to take belt-tightening measures like those seen in third-world countries. Social services have been cut for most in need during economic downturn, including services for childcare, health insurance, income support, job training programs, and education. Social services are discretionary budget items which have been sacrificed to the fixed interest income of the creditors who are first in line to get paid. Warren Buffett has warned that America, rather than being an ownership society, is fast becoming a sharecropper's society. Paul Krugman suggested in 2005 New York Times editorial that the correct term is debt peonage society, the system prevalent in the post-Civil War South when debtors were forced to work for their creditors. American corporations are assured of cheap, non-mobile labor of the sort found in third world countries by a medical insurance system and other benefits tied to employment. People dare not quit their jobs, however unsatisfactory, for fear of facing medical catastrophes without insurance, particularly now that the escape hatch of bankruptcy has had some limitations, which have been erroneously expanded through false advertising by the credit industry. As we've discussed in the past, most personal bankruptcies are the result of medical emergencies and other severe misfortunes such as job loss or divorce. The Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005 has been an attempt to erode the protection the government once provided against these unexpected catastrophes, ensuring that working people are kept on a treadmill of personal debt. While on the other hand, loopholes allowing very wealthy people and corporations to go bankrupt and to shield their assets from creditors remain intact. As a footnote, it has to be said that since 2005, the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys has made huge inroads in limiting the attempted shift of the bankruptcy law to the benefit of creditors. And for the most part, the court system has balanced the legal interpretations to make the law very effective for debtors. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. It should be noted that the 2005 bankruptcy bill was written by and for credit card companies over a period of 10 years of heavy-duty lobbying, and the expenditure of somewhere between $70 and $100 million by the credit card industry. Credit card debt reached $735 billion by 2003, more than 11 times the TAB of 1980. Approximately 60% of credit card users do not pay off their monthly balances. And among those users, the average debt carried on their cards is now close to $12,000. This subprime market is actually targeted by banks and credit card companies, which count on the poor, the working poor, and the financially strapped to not be able to make their payments. According to the 2003 book titled The Two Income Trap by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, quote, more than 75% of credit card profits come from people who make those low minimum monthly payments. And who makes minimum monthly payments at 26% interest? Who pays late fees, overbalance charges, and cash advance premiums? Families that can barely make ends meet. Households precariously balanced between the financial survival and complete collapse. These are the families that are singled out by the lending industry, barraged with special offers, personalized advertisements, and home phone calls, all with one objective in mind: get them to borrow more money. End quote. Payday lender operations offering small paycheck advance loans have mushroomed. Particularly popular in poor and minority communities, they can carry usurious interest rates as high as 500%. The debt crisis has been blamed on the imprudent spending habits of people buying frivolous things, but Warren and Tyagi observe that two-income families are actually spending 21% less on clothing, 22% less on food, and 44% less on appliances than one-income families spent a generation earlier. The reason is that they are spending substantially more on soaring housing prices and medical costs. In 2003, the average family was spending 69% more on home mortgage payments in inflation-adjusted dollars than their parents spent a generation earlier, and 61% more on health needs. At the same time, real wages had stagnated or declined. Most people were struggling to get by with less, and in order to get by, many turned to credit cards to pay for basic necessities. Credit card companies and their affiliated banks capitalize on the extremity of poor and working class people by using high-pressure tactics to sign up borrowers they know can't afford their loans, then jacking up interest rates or forcing customers to buy insurance on the loans. People who can make only minimal payments on their credit card bills wind up in debt peonage to the banks. The scenario recalls the sinister observation made in the Hazard Circular, which was said to have been circulated during the American Civil War. Quote, slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers, while the European plan, led by England, is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. The great debt that capitalists will see to it is made out of the war must be used as a means to control the volume of money. End quote. The slaves kept in the pre-Civil War South had to be fed and cared for. People enslaved by debt must feed and house themselves. The apparent justification for allowing lenders to charge whatever interest the market will bear is that it recognizes the time value of money. Lenders are said to be entitled to this fee in return for foregoing the use of their money for a period of time. That argument might have some merit if the lenders actually were lending their own money, but in the case of credit card and other commercial bank debt, they aren't. They aren't even lending their depositors' money. They are lending nothing but the borrower's own credit. We know this because of what the Chicago Fed said in Modern Money Mechanics. Quote, of course, banks do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is accept promissory notes in exchange for credits to the borrower's transaction accounts. Loans, which are assets, and deposits, liabilities, both rise by the same amount. End quote. So here's how the credit card scheme works. When you sign a merchant's credit card charge slip, you are creating a negotiable instrument. A negotiable instrument is anything that is signed and convertible into money or that can be used as money. The merchant takes this negotiable instrument and deposits it into his merchant's checking account, a special account required of all businesses that accept credit. The account goes up by the amount on the slip, indicating that the merchant has been paid. The charge slip is forwarded to the credit card company, Visa, MasterCard, etc., which bundles your charges and sends them to a bank. The bank then sends you a statement, which you pay with a check, causing your transaction account to be debited at your bank. At no point has a bank lent you its money or its depositor's money. Rather, your charge slip, a negotiable instrument, has become an asset against which credit has been advanced. The bank has done nothing but monetize your own IOU or promise to repay. When you lend someone your own money, your assets go down by the amount that the borrower's assets go up. But when a bank lends you money, its assets go up. Its liabilities also go up since its deposits are counted as liabilities, but the money isn't really there. It is simply a liability, something that is owed back to the depositor. The bank turns your promise to pay into an asset and a liability at the same time, balancing its books without actually transferring any pre-existing money to you. The spiraling debt trap that has subjected financially strapped people to usurious interest charges for the use of something the lenders never had to lend is effectively a fraud on the borrowers. In 2006, profits to lenders from interest charges and late fees on U.S. credit card debt came to $90 billion. An alternative for retaining the benefits of credit card systems without feeding a parasitic class of unnecessary middlemen will be discussed later. I'd like to end, however, by repeating this very important fundamental concept. When you lend someone your own money, your assets go down by the amount that the borrower's assets go up. But when a bank lends you money, its assets go up. Its liabilities also go up since its deposits are counted as liabilities, but the money isn't really there. It is simply a liability, something that is owed back to the depositor. The bank turns your promise to pay into an asset and a liability at the same time, balancing its books without actually transferring any pre-existing money to you. At no point has a bank lent you its money or its depositor's money. Rather, your charge slip, which, as we talked about, is a negotiable instrument, has become an asset against which credit has been advanced. The bank has done nothing but monetize your own IOU or promise to repay. It's all a sleight of hand, and we have all become slaves to it. And I will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.